lodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bear.
Morpheus tells Neo that the Matrix is the world that was pulled over your eyes to hide you from the truth. As long as the Matrix exists, humanity cannot be free. Consensus political reality is precisely such a matrix.
And as we go riding in the damp, foggy...
As long as we have a war machine in Washington, and it, every time it needs a war, it gets its war by deep events. Since 1950, every single major U.S. war has been predicted by one.
You're listening to episode 686 of Unwelcome Guests. The U.S. Deep State, 1981 to 2001. I'm Robin Upton, and we've just heard Lynn Gary on The Matrix and Peter Dale Scott on The American War Machine. We're going to continue more or less where we left off last time, reading from Mark Gorton, with Peter Dale Scott in the second hour. I think The Matrix is a fantastic metaphor for explaining how the reality of deep events is fundamentally different from the lies which are told about them, and which many people fail to even notice, never mind question. So let's start with a few minutes of Lynn Gary reading from Richard K. Moore's Escaping the Matrix from episode 87.
Moore begins the article by asking, "Are you ready for the red pill?" The defining dramatic moment in the film The Matrix occurs just after Morpheus invites Neo to choose between a red pill and a blue pill. The red pill promises the truth, nothing more. Neo takes the red pill and awakes to reality, something utterly different from anything Neo or the audience could have expected. What Neo had assumed to be reality turned out to be only a collective illusion, fabricated by the Matrix and fed to a population that is asleep, cocooned in grotesque embryonic pods. In Plato's famous parable about the shadows on the walls of the cave, true reality is at least reflected in perceived reality. In the Matrix world, true reality and perceived reality exist on entirely different planes. The story is intended as a metaphor, and the parallels that drew my attention had to do with political reality. This article offers a particular perspective on what's going on in the world and how things got to be that way in this era of globalization. From that red pill perspective, everyday media consensus reality, like the Matrix in the film, is seen to be a fabricated collective illusion. Like Neo, I didn't know what I was looking for when my investigation began, but I knew that what I was being told didn't make sense. I read scores of histories and biographies, observing connections between them, and began to develop my own theories about roots of various historical events. I found myself largely in agreement with writers like Noam Chomsky and Michael Parenti, but I also perceived important patterns that others seemed to have missed. When I started tracing historical forces and began to interpret present-day events from a historical perspective, I could see the same old dynamics at work and found a meaning in the unfolding events far different from what official pronouncements proclaimed. Such pronouncements are, after all, public relations fare given out by politicians who want to look good to the voters. Most of us expect rhetoric from politicians and take what they say with a grain of salt. But as my own picture of present reality came into focus, grain of salt no longer worked as a metaphor. I began to see that consensus reality, as generated by official rhetoric and amplified by mass media, bears very little relationship to actual reality. The Matrix was a metaphor I was ready for.
Now we resume where we left off last time, reading from businessman Mark Gorton's essay, 50 Years of the Deep State, The Reagan Administration. Within an hour of Reagan being sworn in as president, the Iranians released the hostages. As Vice President, George H.W. Bush was able to assume unprecedented control over the national security infrastructure without Reagan understanding what was happening. Republican CIA counter-surprise point man William Casey was rewarded for his act of treason by being made director of the CIA. With Bush as Vice President, Cheney as DCI, and Reagan dozing on the job, the cabal was well positioned to run the country behind the scenes. As Vice President, Bush represented the United States on a committee of heads of international intelligence agencies. This working group had the capability to task a number of assassination teams for a variety of intelligence agencies. Without any formal or legal oversight, this committee had the power to kill, with impunity, nearly anyone in the world. Just 2 months into the Reagan administration, John Hinckley Jr. attempted to kill Ronald Reagan. There is good reason to believe that this planned assassination was another attempted coup d'etat. The Bush and Hinckley families were close. The day after the assassination attempt, John Hinckley's brother, Scott, was scheduled to have dinner with the Vice President Bush's son, Neil. In addition, earlier in his career, John Hinckley Sr., the gunman's father, worked for World Vision, an organization with close ties to the intelligence community. Now, we're going to pause Gorton there because I knew very little about this and I thought, well, he hasn't said a lot. I need to have a look and see whether this really checks out. So I did a little bit of research on my own and, to cut a long story short, ended up going down a different, although somehow connected, rabbit hole. And there's a lesson there. I'm researching and making programs on deep politics, and I still get surprised by how apparently separate events end up being connected if you look closely. We're going to hear what Gorton has to say about George H.W. Bush in just a minute, but for now, let's hear the following snippet of a program that was broadcast by Jack Blood on the 25th anniversary of the assassination of John Lennon.
I just want to say the Reagan administration, because it might be more accurate to call it the Bush administration.
Sure,
and that's because there are so many parallels between the assassination of John Lennon and the attempted assassination on Ronald Reagan, which came just 3 months later.
Yeah, that's right. Well, let's break this down for people. There's really a lot to it, and I hope we get to most of it on the program. But December 8, 1980, 10:50 p.m., again, just 1 month after Ronald Reagan was elected president, John Lennon was assassinated. He was gunned down in front of the Dakota in New York City. Now, you know, of course, everyone, you have the perfect patsy. You have a lone gunman reading Catcher in the Rye, conveniently enough. While the police are on their way, there was a subway, I believe, what, 60 feet away that he could have ducked into. But here is the guy that just does not fit into this scheme at all. His name is Jose Perdermo, who was a Cuban nationalist, right?
It appears that way. This guy's name was Jose Perdomo, and he was the doorman, and so he was outside of he was outside of the Dakota the whole time this was happening, and Mark David Chapman comes up, and he just sat there all day. First he got Lennon to autograph a copy of the new album, and then he just kind of hung out there all day, and apparently behind the first gate to the building, because, you know, there's a gate on the sidewalk, yeah. And then the building's back behind that. And this man, Perdomo, just let him hang out all day, and apparently they chatted about the Kennedy assassination, is what he says.
And they were talking about the Bay of Pigs and a number of issues going on in Cuba. I mean, this is the thing, James. I'm going to stop here for a second, because when you're looking at the Kennedy assassination, you're looking at you know, the Nixon scandals, you're looking at the Bay of Pigs. I mean, there are a number of similarities here, and here it is in John Lennon. I mean, you know, of course, again, you mentioned the Bush presidency being the Reagan presidency. These are all things that Bush was involved in. I'm not saying that Bush assassinated Lennon by any means here, but again, I mean, I think he was certainly in the loop. And what a strange coincidence that, you know, no matter what happened when we're talking about assassinations, it always kind of leads back to Cuba somehow.
Yeah, in this case, Jose Perdomo appears to be. There was a Jose Perdomo who was involved in the Bay of Pigs assassination, invasion,
right.
and all these operations, particularly one called Operation 40, which was kind of many intelligence agencies set up in South Florida for these Cuban operations, and you know, connected to people like.
So we don't know if it's the same Jose Perdomo or not.
There's a lot of evidence that indicates it probably was the same guy. The one problem would be was that one of his spy buddies, Frank Sturgis, who lots of people have connected to Watergate and all this,
yeah.
Claimed in the mid '70s that. Perdomo died, and so he went by different names. There was a name Joaquin Sanyenas. His full name was Jose Joaquin Sanyenas Perdomo, and they kind of kept the name of this doorman quiet for many years. It wasn't mentioned in print until about 7 or 8 years later in People magazine.
Yeah.
And it's from there that people started making the connections, even though his name did appear, Jose Perdomo, his name, in fact, a photo, did appear on NBC a couple of weeks ago in a special about the assassination. So as far as Cuban exiles named Jose Perdomo go, I don't know if there were any other ones.
I shall link to the full interview from this show's webpage, unwelcomeguests.net/686. Continue reading from Mark Gorton's 50 Years of the Deep State. The Enterprise. Ensconced in the Vice President's office, Bush set out to build a criminal organization without parallel in U.S. history. Many elements of this criminal organization later became known under various names: Iran-Contra, the Savings and Loan Scandal, CIA-DEA drug trafficking, the HUD fraud, etc. However, the press reports either failed to comprehend or failed to report the common organization behind these crimes. Iran-Contra conspirator General Richard Secord called it the Enterprise, and that term perhaps best describes the organization. The Enterprise was a massive 5,000-person large hierarchical criminal organization with George H.W. Bush as its CEO. The Enterprise was a multifaceted criminal conglomerate that ran a large number of criminal activities, including drug trafficking, arms trafficking, savings and loan fraud, securities fraud, oil and gas fraud, insurance fraud, and real estate fraud. Embedded within the national security infrastructure and protected from prosecution by corrupted enforcement agencies like the SEC, the FBI, the DEA, the ATF, etc., the Enterprise embarked on a massive criminal romp. Senior members of the Enterprise included William Casey, Richard Secord, Richard Armitage, Oliver North, John Poindexter, Edwin Wilson, Thomas Kleins, Donald Gregg, and Felix Rodriguez. During this time, the transition of the cabal to an increasingly Bush family-centered syndicate continued. Much like a mob family, the next generation of the Bush family was brought into the family crime business. Members of the younger generation of the Bush family specialized in particular types of fraud. George W. Bush's specialty was insurance fraud. Neil Bush specialized in real estate fraud. Jeb Bush was involved in a wider variety of frauds: banking, securities, real estate, oil and gas, gold bullion, and aircraft brokerage funds. As with all George H.W. Bush operations, the Enterprise served many purposes. The most obvious motive was pure greed. Billions of dollars were plundered in a wide variety of frauds and crimes. But more importantly, Bush and the cabal needed to spread and perpetuate a criminal milieu within government. An honest government was an enormous threat to Bush and the cabal. They had, and have, a never-ending need to continue to commit more crimes in order to create new generations of criminals to maintain the criminal environment which protected them. Crime was the Bush family business. Just as Prescott Bush inducted George H.W. to the criminal life partially to protect himself from exposure of his World War II-era treason, fraud, and theft, George H.W. committed his sons to a life of crime so that the next generation would do their duty to protect their father and their family's criminal past. The financial frauds conducted by the Enterprise were designed to implicate, enrich, and entrap a huge swath of the political class in D.C. Fraudulent securities or oil and gas deals were offered to friends to enrich them and enemies to entrap them. In some cases, Enemies were suckered in with easy profits on small investments, only to be bankrupted when larger fraudulent investments imploded. By the time that the Iran-Contra scandal made the headlines, such a large number of congressmen and DC insiders were implicated that any attempt to expose the scale of the scandal would have resulted in a near wholesale implication of the political class. In many ways, this endemic corruption is what makes political reform in Washington so difficult. The level of corruption is so pervasive that the political class has no choice but to cover for each other's crimes or risk mutually assured destruction. George H.W. Bush was the greatest criminal mastermind in American history. His criminal operations work on many, many levels. In addition to pure looting, the building and strengthening of his criminal base within government, and the systematic corruption control of political class in Washington, the Iran-Contra operation served another, little understood, purpose. Eventually, the large-scale looting of the savings and loans, the securities fraud, the oil and gas frauds, the insurance frauds, all began to come to light, and the end of the enterprise was clearly in sight. At this point, an attempt was made to deliberately expose some drug and gun-running aspects of the enterprise and to blame them on Reagan in an attempt to force him to resign. The falsely blaming the president for crimes with which he was not associated has strong parallels to the Watergate coup and makes Iran-Contra the fourth coup attempt in George H.W. Bush's career. However, Reagan loyalists Edwin Meese and George Shultz were able to fight off the coup, and Reagan's presidency survived. One reason that understanding the enterprise is important today is that the network of people involved in the enterprise did not go away. These individuals continued their long, active criminal careers, and some of the people responsible for the 9/11 operation can be found to have previous working relationships during the days of the enterprise. As the large variety of crimes associated with the enterprise came to light, the press reported on a variety of scandals senior leadership of the enterprise needed to insulate themselves from exposure. The tactic they used to protect the upper management of the enterprise was the systematic killing of a huge number of middle-level players in the enterprise. In all, over 400 people were killed in the cover-up of the crimes of the enterprise. The vast majority of those killed were mid-level operational members of the enterprise, but a fair number of reporters were also killed to keep the true nature of the organization from being exposed. In order to facilitate the cover-up, Congress began an investigation by establishing the House Select Committee to investigate covert arms transactions with Iran. The most important figure on the committee was senior Republican member Richard Cheney. As a result, George H.W. Bush was totally exonerated by the final report. Bill Clinton. One part of the enterprise's criminal portfolio was drug trafficking. The CIA has had a long history of involvement in the drug business, going back to its post-World War II relationship with the Marseille Heroin Syndicate. As a side note, the CIA-Marseille Mafia relationship was leveraged to recruit Lucien Sarti, one of the gunmen behind the Grassy Knoll in Dallas. During the Vietnam War, the majority of the heroin supply in Vietnam and the Golden Triangle was controlled and trafficked under the supervision of the CIA. During the mid-1980s, the primary transshipment point for CIA military drug trafficking was Mena, Arkansas. Under the enterprise, George H.W. Bush was the drug lord of the United States, and Governor Bill Clinton was the Arkansas state representative of the enterprise. This criminal alliance between Bush and Clinton provided the basis for Clinton's rise to national prominence. In addition, a number of financial and oil and gas frauds were run out of Arkansas, with Hillary Clinton acting as counsel to several bogus corporations. From a young age, Bill Clinton had known that the path to power was through winning the favor of the rich and powerful men who controlled the power structure. In 1968, while at Oxford, ambitious young Bill Clinton was recruited as a CIA asset by CIA London Station Chief Cord Meyer. Cord Meyer was a very significant figure in the coup of 63, when he ran the media cover-up, propaganda side of the coup. The cabal was always looking to groom a next generation of members, and from the point of view of the CIA cabal, Clinton must have made an ideal target. He was smart, charismatic, ambitious, and he couldn't keep his dick in his pants. That combination of traits made him very controllable. Clinton's rise to prominence within Arkansas politics was financed by a network of Arkansas organized crime figures prominent in the illegal gambling and drug money laundering business. Many members of Clinton's inner circle were involved in the money laundering and drug running businesses, and Clinton was easily drawn into supporting and protecting the illegal CIA-sponsored drug and gun running based in Arkansas. By participating in these criminal acts, Clinton earned his right to join the cabal, and he was rewarded by having the Bush syndicate use their influence to promote him on the national stage. The cabal transcends any political party. The cabal is always looking to penetrate and control both political parties. So during the 1992 presidential elections, the cabal couldn't lose. Cabal leader George H.W. Bush had the Republican nomination, and compromised junior cabal member Clinton was the Democratic candidate. Despite his corrupt stewardship of Arkansas, and despite his willingness to ally himself with criminal scumbags, when Clinton did attain the presidencies, his policies were relatively solid, and his administration was not nearly the kleptocracy of the Bushes or LBJ. However, since both Bill and Hillary had criminal backgrounds in drug running, money laundering, and financial fraud that intertwined with the enterprise, Clinton was obligated to maintain the large network of people committed to covering up high-level government-embedded crime by carrying over the appointments of over 1,000 Bush appointees who had been placed throughout the federal government for the reason of covering up the crimes of the enterprise. Clinton's administration was indicative of the limited potential for political change in D.C. without confronting the deep-seated problems of the secret government. Under Clinton, marginal management improvements were made within the federal government, and new criminal and imperialistic ventures were kept to a minimum. But the fundamental capabilities of the power control group were not challenged, and the criminal structures of the secret government worked quietly, waiting for the next member of the Bush syndicate to take office. What started for me as a study of the assassination of JFK continued to move forward in time. I had stumbled upon the Watergate coup while researching George H.W. Bush's involvement in the coup of 63 by reading Russ Baker's excellent book, Family of Secrets. This discovery sent me on a tangent of researching Watergate that lasted over 6 months. Then I bumped into The Enterprise while reading Defrauding America by Rodney Stitch, while tracking down a reference to a CIA recording of J. Edgar Hoover talking to Nelson Rockefeller about the planned killing of JFK. Defrauding America is a book that every American citizen should read. I found it painful to read, and in the course of reading it, I had to stop 3 times to take a break because I found its contents so disturbing. Even though I already knew that America had suffered 2 secret coups d'etat, I still did not understand the level of criminalization of the federal government. I didn't understand that significant elements of the judiciary were corrupt, too. I didn't know that American jails held American citizens as political prisoners. Each of these discoveries was painful for me to accept. Defrauding America led me to the crucial insight that George H.W. Bush was the kingpin of the cabal, and I got a sense for the sophistication and complete amorality of his operations. By combining what I learned from Defrauding America with a bit that I knew about the FBI's cover-up of investigations into 9/11, I had a hunch that 9/11 was a Bush syndicate operation. And that hunch led me to spend much of the last 18 months studying 9/11 and a number of other acts of terrorism and the post-9/11 activity of the cabal. The Oklahoma City bombing. The next government-sponsored terrorist attack to be falsely blamed on the militia movement was the Oklahoma City bombing. A combination of domestic and international intelligence agencies inserted agents provocateurs into local militia groups. The agent provocateurs managed to motivate the otherwise harmless militia groups into enough action that they provided an adequate front for the Oklahoma City bombing. The actual bombing was a professional job that involved wiring parts of the Murrow office building with explosives and parking a truck with military-grade explosives, much, much more powerful than the crude fertilizer bombs that Timothy McVeigh supposedly built. The ATF staff located in the Murrow office building in Oklahoma City received advance word of the bombing and did not show up at the office that day. However, this advance warning was not passed to the people running the daycare center in the building, and 19 children under the age of 6 were among the 168 people killed. Timothy McVeigh was the patsy in this attack. The OKC bombing served at least two purposes. It removed public sympathy for the militia movement that had grown after the Waco attacks, and it destroyed an FBI investigation being run out of the Murrow building that would have exposed certain elements of the enterprise. Another result of the OKC bombing was that the militia movement was so weakened that it could no longer serve as an adequate basis for fake terror attacks. Now, the style changes here. It's quite clearly a work in progress. There's a few isolated notes, but I'm going to skip over. There's a section heading called the 1993 World Trade Center bombing. So Mark Gorton clearly suspects that that was another inside job. And the next complete section, 9/11 overview. As I researched the elements surrounding 9/11, it didn't take me long to recognize that the official story of 9/11 was a cover-up for a much darker truth. By the time I started studying the 9/11 attacks, I had a good deal of experience studying domestic criminal operations masterminded by George H.W. Bush. I had an appreciation of the many levels on which his plots work, and the sheer breadth and scope of them. I was already familiar with many black op techniques, security pullbacks, congressional investigations as part of a domestic plot, the secret government, etc. So I was well equipped to be able to start my investigation into 9/11. Yet, despite my knowledge of the criminal cabal embedded within our government, for the first 11 years after 9/11, it never occurred to me that there might be anything more to the story of 9/11 than the standard story believed by most Americans. Now, after a year and a half of research, I understand the basic structure and many of the elements of the 9/11 plot. However, the 9/11 plot is still relatively young and fresh, and no doubt revelations will continue for the next 50 years. Much of the detail of the events surrounding the coup of 63 has only come to light in the last 10 or 20 years, as many people who kept silent for decades slowly felt comfortable telling their stories, and long classified records came to light. 9/11 was a massive operation, and only the most visible elements of the plot have been investigated. But despite the mass of information yet to be discovered, enough information exists to clearly demonstrate that 9/11 was a massive, domestic-run black op. The key players behind 9/11 were the Bush family, George H.W., George W., and Marvin, and perhaps others, Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, the neocons surrounding PNAC, Paul Wolfowitz, Scooter Libby, Richard Armitage, Saudi Prince Bandar, Saudi intelligence and senior Saudi leadership, elements within the CIA, the FBI, and the ISI, that's Pakistani intelligence. Saudi government involvement in the 9/11 attacks. Superficially, the story behind the 9/11 attacks is that a group of Muslim fundamentalists hijacked planes and crashed them into the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. However, a deeper look shows these hijackers to be puppets manipulated by a series of intelligence agencies. And these intelligence agencies are then connected to the global criminal syndicate centered upon the Bush family and the Saudi leadership. The 2002 congressional inquiry into the 9/11 attacks contained a section named Specific Sources of Foreign Support for the Hijackers. President Bush censored these 28 full pages from the report. In 2013, after great effort, Representatives Walter Jones and Stephen Lynch were allowed to read the classified section. They said they were absolutely shocked at levels of foreign state involvement in the attacks. The hijackers were funded by Saudi and Pakistani intelligence. The wife of Saudi Prince Bandar sent checks totaling $130,000 to Saudi agents that was then funneled to the hijackers. But beyond the funding, the hijackers required operational support in order to be able to pull off the hijackings. All along the way, the hijackers had their hands held by either Saudi or Pakistani operatives. Senator Bob Graham, who co-headed the 2002 joint congressional inquiries into the 9/11 attacks, filed a sworn affidavit in 2012, which said, quote, "I am convinced that there was a direct line between at least some of the terrorists who carried out the September 11th attacks and the government of Saudi Arabia." Unquote. Eckhard Werterbach, former head of Germany's domestic intelligence service, said, quote, "Such a sophisticated operation would require the fixed frame of a state intelligence organization, something not found in a loose group like the one led by the student Mohammed Atta in Hamburg." Unquote. The rulers of Saudi Arabia are very conservative. They are among the very richest people on the planet. Saudi Arabia is a very close ally to the US. The Saudi ambassador to the US from 1983 to 2005 was Prince Bandar bin Sultan. Prince Bandar was so close to George H.W. Bush that he was often described as a member of the former president's family and was given the nickname Bandar Bush. So why would the rulers of Saudi Arabia risk bringing the wrath of the US down upon them by attacking a close ally? How could the rulers of Saudi Arabia be certain that in the days after the 9/11 attacks, President Bush would open the closed US airspace to only allow flights of senior Saudis, including relatives of Osama bin Laden, to leave the country without being questioned? How could the rulers of Saudi Arabia know that the Bush administration would suppress, censor, and downplay information related to Saudi government involvement in the 9/11 attacks? How could the Saudi rulers be certain that the Bush administration would commit acts of treason to protect an enemy state that attacked America? The answer to these questions is that the Saudi rulers would never have risked such a foolhardy attack without the prior knowledge, consent, and support of President Bush, Vice President Cheney, and the people around them. Attacking America was the one thing that could have displaced the rulers of Saudi Arabia from their extremely cushy spot, awash in oil, cash, palaces, power, and women. The Saudi rulers would have needed great assurances that their complicity in these attacks would not have been allowed to blow back at them. A further examination of evidence surrounding the 9/11 attacks will show that 9/11 was a Bush syndicate plot in which the Saudis were complicit, rather than the Saudi plot in which the Bush syndicate was complicit. Al-Qaeda. The popular perception of Al-Qaeda is that its members were crazy zealots in a holy war against the United States. But historically, Al-Qaeda has functioned more like a freelance mercenary army, guided by the CIA through the proxies of the Saudi and Pakistani intelligence services. Al-Qaeda evolved out of the CIA-funded Mujahideen army that fought the Soviets in the 1980s in Afghanistan. After driving the Soviets from Afghanistan, the radical fundamentalist Mujahideen fighters were reorganized under the banner of Al-Qaeda and were employed as mercenaries on behalf of the US and Saudi oil companies and the CIA fighting proxy wars against Russian influence in Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, Kosovo, and Azerbaijan. Al-Qaeda's actions served to destabilize Central Asia and shift control of the natural resources of Central Asia from Russian to US and Saudi control. A key organization guiding the US effort to control the oil and gas of Azerbaijan was the US-Azerbaijan Chamber of Commerce, whose members included Dick Cheney, Richard Armitage, Richard Pearl, and James Baker IV. The core of the 9/11 operation centered around the Bush Syndicate and the leaders of the Saudi government and intelligence agencies. This network of individuals had been working together since the mid-1970s and the formation of the Safari Club. The Saudi U.S. intelligence cabal was involved in the CIA Republican counter-surprise, Iran-Contra BCCI, and numerous oil and gas deals throughout the Middle East, Azerbaijan, and Afghanistan. Saudi intelligence operatives paved the way for the hijackers by setting up apartments, providing phones, paying rent, setting up meetings to get the hijackers established in America. The hijackers were shepherded and guided around the U.S. by Saudi intelligence agents and their allies in the U.S. In addition, many of the flight schools at which the pilot hijackers attended were owned by people with connections to Saudi intelligence. The hijackers were also supported by the Pakistani government. Director General of the ISI, that's Pakistan's CIA, Lieutenant General Mahmoud Ahmed, ordered $100,000 transferred to the account of Mohammed Atta, one of the lead coordinators of the hijackers. As an interesting side note, at the time of the 9/11 attacks, General Mahmoud was meeting with Senator Bob Graham and Representative Porter Goss, who would both go on to head the first congressional 9/11 investigation. Porter Goss was a CIA covert operative who worked closely with many people involved in the coup of 63. The stripping of anti-terror protections. The popular myth about 9/11 states that the hijackers were able to roam free in the United States for years, planning their attacks without law enforcement agencies noticing them or doing anything. But a closer examination of the facts shows that many law enforcement personnel identified the hijackers, tried to stop them, but were restrained by anti-terror officials high up in the FBI and CIA. The FBI and CIA groups nominally responsible for stopping al-Qaeda instead worked to facilitate the hijackers' free operation in the U.S. Based within the CIA's Get Al-Qaeda unit, ALEC station, and the FBI's Radical Fundamentalist unit, criminal members of the secret government were perfectly positioned to guide and shelter the al-Qaeda penetration of America. If normal policies regarding State Department terror watch lists were allowed to function as designed, few, if any, of the hijackers would have been able to even enter the United States. However, the CIA both facilitated the granting of visas to known or potential terrorists and also repeatedly prevented known terrorists from being put on terror watch lists that would have kept them out of the country. J. Michael Springman, former U.S. consulate visa officer in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, put it succinctly when he said, quote, "The CIA forced me to allow terrorists into the U.S." unquote. Within the CIA, the ALEC station group was dedicated to focusing on al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden. Senior members of ALEC station, including Tom Wilshire, Richard Blee, and Alfreda Bikowski, all committed multiple acts of treason by frustrating the elements of honest law enforcement officials to stop the 9/11 plot. The members of ALEC station not only sabotaged efforts by FBI agents desperate to stop known terrorists from entering the US, but they created a fake cover story to hide their criminal actions, showing that this active enabling of terrorists was not incompetence but deliberate support of the terrorist plots. Although the CIA suppression of anti-terror efforts was centered around ALEC station, the failure to pursue terrorists and the protection of terrorists was carried out by multiple CIA stations, indicating high-level support for these actions. In 1999 to 2000, Able Danger, a military intelligence program which mined publicly available data, identified two operational al-Qaeda cells preparing for the 9/11 attacks. U.S. Special Operations Command, SOCOM, began preparations to take action against these terrorist cells. However, in October of 2000, CIA Director George Tenet faced off against Army General Bob Hardy Jr. in a closed session before the House Intelligence Committee and forced the cancelling of the Able Danger program and the SOCOM attempts to take down the al-Qaeda cells. George Tenet was CIA director from 1997 to 2004. Prior to taking the helm at the CIA, Tenet served as deputy director. Tenet cultivated close personal relationships with officials in Saudi Arabia, particularly Prince Bandar, whose wife funded the hijackers. as deputy director of the CIA in 1996, Tenet installed one of his closest friends, John Brennan, as CIA station chief in Saudi Arabia. In this role, Brennan often communicated directly with Tenet, avoiding the usual chain of command. Under Tenet's leadership, the CIA trumpeted the terrorist threat while repeatedly failing to pursue and actively sabotaging opportunities to capture or stop terrorists. Counter-terrorism czar Richard Clarke was close friends with the royal family of the United Arab Emirates, who created the BCCI terrorist network. Clarke was behind the failure of two CIA attempts to capture or kill bin Laden in 1999. He effectively opposed a CIA request to attack a training camp where bin Laden had been located, and the next month, when the CIA was preparing to take out bin Laden during an Afghanistan hunting trip, committing an act of treason, Clarke informed his UAE friends about the CIA plans. The UAE royals tipped off bin Laden, and the US lost another opportunity to take out Osama bin Laden. The FBI played a key role in allowing the 9/11 attacks to take place, with responsibility for overseeing terrorist investigations. Having FBI involvement was key to allowing the 9/11 attacks to take place. Numerous examples exist of the FBI failing to take the appropriate action to follow up on clear evidence of brewing terrorist plots or actually sabotaging investigations by honest investigators within the FBI. Below is just a small sample of some of the many warnings and leads. In November of 2000, Dr. David Graham of Shreveport met with 9/11 hijackers Nawaf al-Hazmi and Fayez Bani Hamad. After suspecting Mohammed Jamal Khan, al-Hazmi, and Bani Hamad of preparing for a terrorist attack, Dr. Graham contacted the FBI. The FBI responded by making threatening comments to Graham and suggesting that he might be killed for reporting Jamal Khan. During the 2002 to 2004 period, Dr. Graham worked to investigate the terrorist activity in Shreveport, and he wrote a book, The 9/11 Graham Report. The FBI strongly urged Graham to not publish his book, and when he did, Graham was poisoned. After being poisoned, and before his death, Dr. Graham indicated that he thought the FBI was behind his poisoning. On August the 16th, 2001, the FBI field office in Minneapolis arrested Zacharias Moussaoui, the so-called 20th hijacker, after learning of his plans to hijack a jetliner and use it for a terrorist attack. The FBI Minneapolis field office tried like hell to follow up on this arrest, but were repeatedly stopped by the FBI's Radical Fundamentalist Unit in D.C. The unit's sabotage of this terrorist investigation went on for weeks, involved multiple people, and included threatening the careers of Minneapolis FBI agents who tried to pursue the investigation. In April 2000, Niaz Khan told the FBI that he was recruited by Al-Qaeda and trained to hijack planes and sent to the U.S. for a terror mission along with several pilots. FBI agents in Newark, New Jersey, interviewed Khan for 3 weeks, gave Khan a polygraph, which he passed. The FBI agents believed Khan's story and aggressively tried to follow up, but word came down from FBI headquarters saying, quote, "Return him to London and forget about it," unquote. On July the 10th, 2001, FBI Special Agent Kenneth Williams, stationed in Phoenix, sent a memo to headquarters to, quote, "advise the Bureau and New York of the possibility of a coordinated effort by Osama bin Laden to send students to the United States to attend civil aviation universities and colleges. Phoenix has observed an inordinate number of individuals of investigative interest who are attending or who have attended civil aviation universities and colleges in the state of Arizona," unquote. But although this memo was seen by at least a dozen FBI officials, nothing was done to follow up. Honest FBI agents who did not get the message that they were not to interfere with terrorists operating in the U.S. were driven out of the FBI. John O'Neill, the FBI's best Al-Qaeda expert, was harassed by a pointless investigation into a briefcase with classified information that he misplaced for a couple of hours over a year earlier. The briefcase was locked and never touched. This investigation prevented him from stopping Al-Qaeda and forced him into retirement. FBI informant Janet Parker said of the FBI, quote, "O'Neill's own bureau blocked him every step of the way," unquote. Parker also recalls, during the months before 9/11, O'Neill telling her that someone higher up had blocked attempts to wiretap terrorist suspects, refused to let him return to Yemen, mysteriously deleted all his files at FBI New York headquarters, and then finally relegated him to a desk job far away from the front lines of terrorism. The FBI and CIA support for terrorism extended beyond suppressing anti-terror investigations to include operational support for terrorist attacks. Islamic terrorist Ali Mohammed at various times worked for the FBI, the CIA, and the US Army. Mohammed was involved in training terrorists involved in the 1993 World Trade Center bombing, the New York Landmarks plot, and attacks against Americans in Somalia and Kenya. He trained terrorists on how to hijack planes, including how to smuggle box cutters on board. Despite Mohammed's record of known terrorist activities and being on the State Department watch list, Mohammed was repeatedly allowed to travel to and from America on what an FBI consultant called, quote, "a visa program controlled by the CIA," unquote. In 1993, Mohammed was arrested by the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, but he was released at the request of the FBI. Despite his confessed role in planning the 9/11 attacks, as of 2007, Mohammed had still not been sentenced for his involvement in these crimes. The crippling of U.S. air defenses. Most people have been given the idea that there was little the U.S. Air Force could have done to stop the hijacked airliners from crashing into the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. However, intercepting the hijacked airliners would have been a simple, straightforward exercise for the U.S. Air Force. U.S. air defense planners had spent tens of thousands of man-years and hundreds of billions of dollars designing, developing, and deploying the U.S. domestic air defenses. For decades, the U.S. Air Force had been continually ready to intercept any threat that approached or entered U.S. airspace. As part of its standard operating procedures, the Air Force scrambled fighter jets whenever a jetliner went off course or radio contact with it was lost. In the year 2000, fighters were scrambled to intercept aircraft in response to 129 cases where problems were not immediately resolved. Given the capabilities of the U.S. air defenses and the relative ease of intercepting commercial airliners, the Bush-Cheney cabal had to work hard to cripple the U.S. air defenses. The two main organizations focused on protecting the U.S. from air attack were NORAD, the North American Aerospace Defense Command, and the FAA, the Federal Aviation Administration. Both NORAD and the FAA were infiltrated by cabal members who proceeded to work to sabotage the U.S. air defenses from within. In addition, special attention was paid to jamming the communication interfaces between the FAA and NORAD. Key people were put in place at the FAA and NORAD, who took actions to reduce the effectiveness of the U.S. defenses, and then on September 11, 2001, these agents of the secret government, within the FAA and NORAD, repeatedly failed to respond to the hijackings, were absent, gave orders which paralyzed the fighter response, or sent fighters in the wrong direction. In order to dismantle the capabilities of the U.S. air defenses, on May 8, 2001, President Bush asked Dick Cheney to oversee the National Preparedness Review to evaluate and make recommendations to, quote, "strengthen preparedness against acts of terrorism," unquote. In response to requests from the National Preparedness Review, on June 1, 2001, the Joint Chiefs of Staff issued a memo that overhauled long-established air defense protocols and required that the Secretary of Defense personally authorize any request for fighter intercept of hijacked airliners. This procedure change prevented the intercept of errant airliners that had been a regular occurrence. Air Force Lieutenant Colonel Robert Bowman, former director of Advanced Space Programs Development during the Ford and Carter administrations, and a former U.S. Air Force colonel who flew 101 combat missions, said in 2005, quote, "If our government had merely done nothing, and I say that as an old interceptor pilot, I know the drill, I know what it takes, I know how long it takes, I know what the procedures are, I know what they were, I know what they've changed them to. If our government had merely done nothing and allowed normal procedures to happen on that morning of 9/11, the Twin Towers would still be standing and thousands of dead Americans would still be alive." Unquote. Just as Bush took office, Lieutenant General Michael Canavan was placed in the role of hijack coordinator at the FAA. General Canavan had an unusual background for a hijack coordinator. Prior to taking the job of hijack coordinator, Canavan had been the center of the JSOC, the Joint Special Operations Command, which ran the military's counter-terrorism operations and covert missions. In 1998, Canavan and JSOC undermined a CIA plan to capture Osama bin Laden. As hijack coordinator, Canavan ordered the cover-up of security weaknesses at airports, which eased the hijacker's ability to take over the planes. During the 9/11 attacks, Canavan was inexplicably absent from his job as hijack coordinator. Yet, despite his abysmal performance as hijack coordinator during the worst series of hijackings in U.S. history, just 2 days later, Canavan took part in a so-called Principals Committee meeting chaired by Condoleezza Rice that included all of George W. Bush's so-called War Cabinet. A key tool to confuse the U.S. air defenses and provide cover for the stand-down operation was the use of simulated training exercises. Training exercises are the perfect cover to operationalize real-life terrorist attacks, because they provide the opportunity to have people acting like terrorists and also doing things that terrorists might do. At the same time, these exercises confuse non-participants about whether events are real or simulations. In addition, some exercises were used to occupy resources that could have prevented the terrorist attacks with out-of-the-way training missions. Fighter aircraft that normally would have been situated along the eastern seaboard were sent to Alaska and northern Canada as part of Operation Northern Vigilance, which left air bases near New York and Washington short on fighter aircraft with which to respond to the hijackings. NORAD conducted an annual exercise called Vigilant Guardian. In previous years, Vigilant Guardian was held in late October, but in 2001, Vigilant Guardian was moved to the September 6th to the 11th time period. As part of Vigilant Guardian, false blips were inserted onto the radar screens of the FAA and NORAD's Northeast Air Defense Sector. Many FAA and Air Force personnel initially mistook the actual hijacked aircraft for simulated aircraft that were part of Vigilant Guardian. While fake radar tracks were inserted onto radar screens, real aircraft were allowed into restricted airspace under the pretext of another training exercise. Three E-4Bs and a militarized 747-200 were launched between 8:30 and 9 o'clock on September 11th as part of the Global Guardian exercise. On the day of September 11th, 2001, numerous examples exist of fighters not launched or launched from distant as opposed to closer air bases, and when launched were sent in the wrong direction or put in holding patterns. This sequence of multiple protocol failures and missteps could only have been accomplished by a large coordinated action involving many people scattered throughout NORAD and the FAA. Very senior people at both NORAD and the FAA had to have been knowingly involved in a stand-down operation. Dr. Stephen Pachinik, a former U.S. Navy captain who served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State under Nixon, Ford, and Carter, and also won two prestigious Solomon Awards at the Harvard Medical School as he simultaneously completed a PhD at MIT, said, quote, 9/11 was called a stand-down, a false flag operation, in order to mobilize the American public under false pretenses. It was told to me even by the general on the staff of Wolfowitz.
I will go in front of a federal committee and swear on perjury who the name was of the individual, so we can break it open." Unquote.
And we're stopping reading 50 Years of the Deep State there. I suspect we shall conclude it in our next episode. The next speaker, Noam Chomsky, let me say right from the start, is somebody for whom I have a lot of respect, whose ideas have helped me see through various levels of matrix and government denial, inconsistent statements about this, that, and the other. He's been a regular contributor to the show for the first few years. I agonized long and hard about whether to include this because it doesn't show him in a particularly credible light, but nevertheless, his opinions on 9/11 are instructive. So I decided to include just a couple of minutes. This is a snippet from a longer response to a public presentation he gave, and somebody asked him in the Q&A about 9/11. And this is the pith of what he had to say.
Whatever one thinks about Building 7, frankly, I have no opinion. I don't know as much science and engineering as the people who believe that they have an answer to this. So I am willing to let the professional societies determine it if they get the information. So whatever the facts, there's just overwhelming evidence that the Bush administration wasn't involved. Very elementary evidence. You don't have to be a physicist to understand it. You just have to think for a minute, okay? So let's think for a minute. There's a couple of facts which are uncontroversial, right? One fact that is uncontroversial is that the Bush administration desperately wanted to invade Iraq. That's a long-standing goal. There's good reasons for it. You know, second largest energy resources in the world, right in the middle of the world's major energy-producing region. You know, perfectly obvious reasons, which they in fact later stated. But they were obvious anyway. So they wanted to invade Iraq. One uncontroversial fact. Second uncontroversial fact. They didn't blame the 9/11 on Iraqis. They blamed it on Saudis, mainly. That's their major ally. So they blamed it on people from their major ally, not on the country that they wanted to invade. The third uncontroversial fact, unless they're total lunatics, they would have blamed it on Iraqis if they were involved in any way. That would have given them open season on invading Iraq, total support, international support, the UN resolution, no need to concoct wild stories about the weapons of mass destruction and contacts between Saddam and Al-Qaeda, which of course quickly exploded, discrediting them. No reason to invade Afghanistan, which was mostly a waste of time for them. But they didn't. Well, the conclusion is pretty straightforward. Either they are total lunatics or they weren't involved, and they're not total lunatics. So whatever you think about Building 7, there are other considerations to be concerned with.
All right. I think our speaker answered that question succinctly, so that's the only question we'll have on that topic.
And the most obvious point to make there is how keen the chairperson is to shut down the conversation on 9/11, and the audience also cut in applause to suggest, of course, 9/11's not an inside job. People do have a strong emotional response, and this leads them to make statements such as,
"Whatever the facts."
We've got to be careful about jumping to conclusions about what the US government would do in a deep political situation. We've got to be aware of the likelihood of important evidence that has not yet come to light. So how to deal with this? By looking closely at the evidence that has come to light. I would be rather loath to suggest that the invasion of a country on the other side of the world was
mostly a waste of time for them.
So I think we've got to look closely at speakers such as Charlotte Dennett from two episodes back, who talked about pipelines. And the most glaring weakness that I see in Chomsky's methodology is he's suggesting, well, we leave this up to the professionals, which doesn't just assume their competence as practitioners, which we shouldn't take as read, but it also crucially suggests their integrity is beyond question. Well, if Mark Gorton's analysis is correct, then